tonight, huh? Old drummer. Come on, you.
Well, everybody, we're glad to have you here this evening. You're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Feeney.
And I'm back. It's your co-host, Aaron. I'm here.
We got Aaron back. We heard your complaints loud and clear, and I flew to California myself and pulled him back from RailsConf. And
oh, I wish. Sadly, it wasn't RailsConf. It was Ruby by the Bay.
Oh, Ruby by the Bay.
Yeah.
It's all the same thing, right?
Sure.
Ruby and Rails. It's literally in the name. Ruby on Rails.
Oh, yeah.
It's all the same.
Yeah, it's all the same thing.
folks, if you are enjoying checking out the Drunken UX podcast, please run by our sponsors over at NewCloud. You can check them out at newcloud.com/DrunkenUX. They do interactive maps and other fun things like that. So give them a shout if that's something that you're looking for. Let's see. This week, we are going to be looking at a couple different topics. We've got a couple articles that tickled our fancy, and we wanted to share them with you and the stuff behind them. So we're going to be talking about accessibility again, because that is a topic worth reviewing many times.
I agree.
Since we are coming out of our last episode, where I talked with Brian Olendijk about the Hacks Editor, and the work they're doing in terms of utilizing web components. It wouldn't be a Drunken UX episode if I didn't mispronounce something in the first 5 minutes.
Web explosions.
They're using web components to build up their block editor. And so we've got a piece to share with you about design systems and the way they can leverage web components to make your design work easier.
I want to learn more about this.
It sounds like a fun time, right? It's funny because I have to tell my coworkers at work, as opposed to my coworkers at
home
somewhere else.
Your coworkers at home.
You can always tell when I've learned about something new in preparing for an episode of this, or I've talked to somebody who got me excited about something, because I inevitably start bringing it up at work. And web components is one of those things where it was like, I have this whole talk with Brian, and we learn about it, and we think about, you know, ways we can use it, and I'm already trying to think, like, you know, there's some ways we could make use of that. So we're going to talk about some of that tonight.
I find that the preparation for our shows helps, like, it gives me ideas at my job, too. It's kind of neat.
Yeah, see, really, we're just doing this for us. It has nothing to do with you guys.
Yeah, sorry. Totally.
You're just along for the ride. It's important, and we've talked many times, I think, about, you know, this idea of how you keep up, how you train yourself to learn new things, and I would be lying to disagree with that. Like, this is part of my process, I think.
Yeah.
Talking to other developers, figuring out what they're passionate about and what they're doing and how they're utilizing new technology is my little bit of insight into those things that I'm not doing. And so there is absolutely a self-help, you know, component to this kind of approach. And you don't have to run a podcast to do that. You could just do it.
Honestly, the amount of effort it takes to run a podcast, I'm sure there's a way that's more efficient.
Oh, that's highly true. Let's see. This evening, I am drinking a gingerbread. I was trying to use up some stuff out of my bar.
That's the one that you gave me the recipe for, right? With the
yeah.
The hot or the cinnamon schnapps and the
yep. It's equal parts Bailey's or any Irish cream, Fireball, and peach schnapps.
Oh, peach schnapps?
I'm sorry, butterscotch. I don't know why I said peach. I have no idea why I said peach schnapps. But
I still have a bottle of butterscotch schnapps from the last time I made them.
I made myself a whole shaker so I can just sit here and pour.
Nice.
But the actual thing that I'm having fun with, though, is this last weekend, and there's a photo of it on our Instagram, which you can go check out. I've got these glasses.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, so it's this sort of square-shaped lowball.
Yeah.
It's by a company called Corksicle, and they have not paid for anything. I just happened to get it, and they are the ones who made it. And it's got this giant silicone wedge you shove into it, and then you fill the glass up with water, and you stick it all in your freezer. Then you take it out, you pull the silicone mold out, and you're left with this 45-degree angled piece of ice inside the glass that you pour your drink onto. Now, mine, and Aaron can see, you cannot, obviously, but my wedge is now gone. It has, it has melted enough that it is no longer a wedge, but, I don't hate how gimmicky it is, actually. and if you want to see it, I'm going to, just for the fun of it, I'm going to throw a link to it in our show notes. So
yeah,
go take a look at it.
Pretty cool.
it's like a $17 glass. It's got like 4.5 stars or something on Amazon. It's a well-reviewed, well-liked glass as it turns out. So yeah, I'm just kind of, I'm playing this evening.
I just have, I'm actually getting over a cold. So I have just got orange juice. No vodka or anything.
No fun for Aaron.
Sadly, no. I promise I'll still say dumb things, though. I won't disappoint.
Well, can you do me a favor? Go grab the NyQuil out of the cupboard. And oh just, God. can you pound that for me just real fast?
You know, that would actually be interesting, but I don't know. I can't make any promises on quality.
You have any Sudafed in the cupboard?
Oh.
Yeah, and speaking of Instagram, if you want to check that out, we are at drunkenux.com, instagram.com/drunkenuxpodcast, Twitter and Facebook are just /drunkenux. You can connect with us there and chat with us, give us a holler.
And don't forget drunkenux.com/slack for the link to come join and chat with us. We see new people pop in once in a while. Yeah,
folks, drop in, ask us a question, whatever. My big thing is if you have an idea for a show, that's a great way to just hop on, chat with us about it, let us know what you'd like to hear, and we'll see if we can slot it into a future episode. And so we'd be happy. And if it's something we don't know anything about, we would love to go find somebody who does and bring them in. So,
and if you're someone who knows a lot about it, it could be you.
Yeah. If you want to be on the show, you can also try to, you know, suggest that and be happy for it. Okay. So we've got the future of I labeled it the future of accessibility.
Yeah.
That may not be a great headline, but it's the way I titled it in the show notes.
It's very ominous.
Well, I read the article that you sent me.
Oh, right. Well, it's called The Web We Broke, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely kind of a not rosy, starry-eyed view of things.
There will be a link in the show notes. When you're able, I highly recommend checking this out because I think it's a good... it's not a post-mortem because we're still in the middle of it, but it's kind of a good dive into some of the things we're going to be talking about this evening and how they do or do not play nice with accessibility.
Well, it's a short article,
mm-hmm.
but it is loaded with outside resources. Like, every other word is a link to something, practically. and it's Ethan Marcotte, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you possibly go wrong in that situation? So what he's talking about in this article is this idea that it is 2019. We've been building websites for the better part of... I was going to say, you know, 25 years. Really, it's almost 30 at this point.
Jeez.
But really, you know, the golden age, so to speak, started right around 1995. So, you know, that'd be, what, 24 years. So I was 25. 25
seems
there.
Fine. Yeah.
That was sort of, you know, the ushering in of this modern era that reflects kind of what we have now. And in all of that time, his argument is we are still awful at producing accessible websites.
And so I guess as kind of a breaking the fourth wall here, like we saw this article and thought like we should do a thing about this later. And then there's another article another two articles that came up later, which we'll discuss later in the show, which are about some of the new cool hotness things, like with web components, right?
Yeah.
And so so we have all of this really awesome like stuff pushing technology forward in really awesome and new fun ways. But then we also have this other aspect of kind of the old, not old, but web classic, maybe. Like, the accessibility things are just sort of baseline stuff that, I mean, I guess it's sort of acting as a dragging force on the forward motion one, but at the same time, I think it's also really important. And how do we toe that line in a way that we're still incorporating accessible things, but also pushing things forward in a positive way? And so it seemed like two good topics to juxtapose.
Yeah, yeah. And in part, in lieu of that, so to speak, one of the things that Ethan is making a call to is a research project that WebAIM published. And they went through and they analyzed a million pages. And we'll link specifically directly to the report, but the report is also linked in his article. They analyzed a million pages and tried to find what kind of problems there were.
Okay, I remember that now.
And so there's this section in the article that starts, it hits very high level stuff just to kind of showcase some of the problems.
Wait, a direct quote from the article: "The results are, in a word, abysmal."
Yeah, and they are. One out of every 10 home pages has a skip link to help users jump directly to a page's content, but one out of every 10 of those links were broken. There were roughly 2.1 million layout tables detected and only 114,000 data tables.
Wow. An overwhelming majority of home pages had images without alt text. Pages containing popular JavaScript frameworks were more likely to have accessibility errors than those that didn't use those frameworks. Which is, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I know I've brought this up before.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, that's a jumping off point, because the thing is, it is 2019, we have been doing this forever, we've talked about it on this show in the past, and every conference you go to, somebody's talking about accessibility, and we have been forever. So, why is it still so hard? And, like, thinking about things like, you know, JavaScript frameworks and the like, a lot of these frameworks now come with accessibility functionality baked into them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we still, my worry there is that it's sort of symptomatic of us thinking we can just offload all of our accessibility concerns to the software, and the software will just do it for us.
Well, here's a great example. Like, a lot of, you know, we talk about WordPress a lot on this show, and WordPress forever has had the ability to put alt tag on images. And you can even, I think you might even be able to configure it to where it, like, demands that you include it. But I guarantee there's WordPress sites out there that have images without alt tags.
And I guarantee you almost all of them have images without
but,
it.
But, like, WordPress even makes it easy, because when you put an image into your gallery, at least the last time I used it much, it was this case, you could name the image, and then the name both makes it easier to retrieve the image later, but also I think the name falls through on the alt text, right?
Maybe.
Okay. Well,
I mean, it's not necessarily up to WordPress. It's up to the theme developer in many cases.
Oh, yeah, good point.
You know, and making sure that they implement on a given image, depending on, and this does depend on how the images are being called and, you know, how they're presented in the layout. But yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible to, you know, have images presented in the theme without anything, if that's, you know, if that's what you're after. So, like, in that kind of case, you know, when you think about a WordPress theme, for instance, and people who develop WordPress themes, you know, if you go get your theme from from ThemeForest or something like that, or, you know, a company like ThemeStation or one of these that is known for building themes, that's their bread and butter, they're doing it for, you know, thousands of websites, you can trust what they're making.
It's literally their one job.
Yeah. But for a lot of folks, they are getting by implementing stuff that they don't necessarily understand completely. I would challenge anybody, for the most part, to tell me that they have read every inch of the documentation for WordPress, and they know every hook and all the arguments they take and all of this. And the problem becomes, it's easy to implement something incompletely,
yeah,
that feels complete.
And I think I would like to say that I don't think that we're saying there should be, this shouldn't be a gatekeeping issue. This shouldn't be where you're required to know everything about WordPress, for example, before you use it. Right?
Well, no, but it's, yeah. I mean, yes, I agree. Yeah. No, I don't agree. It's, it's this idea that, no matter what we do, you're talking about an unknown unknown.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you are building your first WordPress theme as a developer and you're relying on the documentation and you're getting by, you find your function, like, that's the function I need.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, it's very easy to use those functions. But if you are somebody who is still learning this stuff and nobody has ever told you, hey, make sure you're including alt text in that image tag that you're writing.
Right.
Then, you know, you don't know what you don't know in that situation. So you right. can't possibly put it in there.
Gotcha.
And that's true of, you know, any kind of technology that if you don't fully understand it, which, I mean, let's face it, most web developers do not understand the technology they are using through and through, whether that's mm-hmm. React, Angular, you know, PHP, are you, you know, Java, take your pick.
Mm-hmm.
We may know a lot, but we don't know it absolutely through and through, and it always leaves that opportunity for doing something not like game breaking wrong, but just not in the most optimal way all the time.
I think part of this is that accessibility is kind of, it's not tacked on, but it's a layer above like the functional and practical aspects of creating content or creating anything on the web. And so you can create something on the web and be blissfully unaware of the world of accessibility, which I think is kind of what you were just saying. Like the unknown unknown. So, you know, you may have an awesome theme. If you're unaware of accessibility concerns, you're not going to know to look for, oh, does this theme automatically do alt text on the theme images that I can't control, unless making a child theme or whatever.
Yeah. Or picking colors. If you've never known somebody or talked to somebody who was colorblind,
mm-hmm. oh yeah,
you are completely and blissfully unaware of the challenges that can come by combining certain colors together.
The red text on a green background.
And I mean, you know for a fact that you have seen a website that has done that at some point in your life.
Probably.
But we do, because as an industry, right, we are an open industry. We are an industry that fosters, you know, challenging things and learning things and experimenting. And this idea of just getting, you know, diving right into the material.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not necessarily a lot of hand-holding that happens in that process, especially when, you know, you think about some of the folks who are really getting into web development. They're getting into it very young.
Yeah.
You know.
Or through boot camps. That's the hot thing right now.
Yeah. And if you're a middle school or high school, or if you're in one of those Code Academy type things mm-hmm. or anything like that, the boot camps, you know, you may be getting into that super young, well before, you know, any kind of formal training would ever even dictate something like, oh, and by the way, here's accessibility, you know? And a lot of those specs also, because we preach a lot, right, this idea of accessibility should be the first thing in the door, basically. Like, it should be part of the conversation from the start. But from a learning aspect, that intrinsically cannot be true.
Yeah.
Because you can't, while you could certainly learn some principles, there is also the technical implementation side to it that you can't use until you understand how the rest of the code works.
You know what, though? Have we mentioned cargo culting on this show before?
I remember that phrase because I remember saying, that's a cool phrase.
Okay, so, you know, new developers cargo cult things all the time. I mean, I'm guilty of it. Like, I did it and still do it sometimes. It just, you if something works, you just replicate because it works. And then if the replicant works, you're good. Why can't we do cargo culting with accessibility stuff? Why can't it be something where, like, well, of course the font contrast ratio looks like this. Why wouldn't it be? Because it works like that. Or, of course, the image has alt text. Why wouldn't it have alt text? where we just sort of like, you know, it's just, it's when you're doing a boot camp or if you're training someone new or if you're learning, there's a book, whatever. Instead of saying like, oh, here, so you have the image tag and the source tag, also saying like, here's the alt tag and you write the description of it here. You just do. Don't ask why. You just do it.
I think the reason that's hard and the reason that doesn't work as well is because, let's take, you know, the font contrast issue. It's easy to put the colors in the page, but there is no feedback.
Yeah.
There is no mechanism by which anything other than if you know I want, you know, yellow text on a white background because that's what my, I thought that looked cool.
Oh.
And, you know, it's a dark yellow. Give me a break. But if that's what I want and I write that code to do that and it works, then, I mean, that's the exact danger of the cargo cult, right?
Sure.
Is that you are repeating something that isn't good for you.
Right.
Because you get the outcome you expect, but you don't necessarily understand the consequences to
that
or long-term implications. And with a contrast ratio, it instinctively requires you to use another tool to then figure it out.
When I was at USCIS, we used this tool called Andy, A-N-D-I, which was made by the SSA, the Social Security. But it's really cool. I put the link in the show notes, and I think that everyone should have this on their bookmarks bar. It's basically what it is. It's a bookmarklet, meaning that it's like a long string of JavaScript in a URL, and you just drag it onto your bookmarks bar, and then on any page at all, you click the button, and then it will evaluate the page and identify any. I think it targets the low hanging fruit. But based on that Ethan Marcotte article, it sounds like that will still generate a lot of hits.
Oh,
so.
Yeah.
So it'll see your images with the alt text. It'll see if you have a table that doesn't have the scoping set correctly.
They're also browser site improve and Axe have both got
Axe,
Chrome plugins. We'll link those too, just for the sake of argument. But they give you, like, they'll scan a page that you've got open in your browser.
AXE is also, the Axe is also used by DQ Labs. That's D-E-Q-U-E-U-E, right? Or is it too many U-E's? D-E-Q-U-E-U-E, like that. They have a product called Attest, and we use that at USCIS also. They have some RSpec things you can use if you do Rails, where it'll automatically evaluate your page for whatever accessibility concerns that you've identified. So you can build that into your automated testing suite as well.
And I think you're right. Like, when we teach people, I think we certainly can say, by the way, as soon as you're done, the very next thing you do is run this tool.
Yeah.
I think that is certainly something you can teach, but only if you're in a teachable setting. If I am sitting up on my computer at 10 o'clock at night before I go to bed and I'm 16 years old and I'm just looking for how do I make font yellow,
right?
I'm going to get a line of CSS and keep going. And that's that challenge. That's that just dive in and learn by doing. And that the learn by doing process is fantastic. And it's something I advocate for and I encourage people in. But we can't pretend like that doesn't also have drawbacks.
I had a boss who used to say that was knowing enough to be dangerous.
Yeah. And the other reason this becomes hard is, and we've said this before, it's nothing new, that the ideas of like design and development and content authoring are distinctly different and incongruent skill sets that you're asking all of those things to align into accessibility. You know, the developers have to build the things accessible. The designers have to know how to design the thing accessible.
Yeah.
And then the content authors need to know how to use the tools to put in the information to make it accessible.
Right.
And those things are hard to get into alignment.
It's a lot of overlap. Yeah.
There's a lot of overlap, but not, it's just not in the right places, I think, to get the right outcome for most places. And I'm saying this very generically because there are certainly places that have solved this, but the solutions are generally unique to each environment because your workflow doesn't look like my workflow.
Right.
The way you know you've developed a tool isn't the way I've developed the tool. The nexus for this really is user experience.
Right.
And to a lesser extent, QA.
You don't need to be drunk, though. That's optional.
Yeah. preferably if you're on the job, don't be.
I think we'll get to more of this later, but I think also building team awareness, you know, like it does have a lot of overlap. There is a lot of areas, but if everyone is educated and trained to be aware of accessibility things like contrast ratio or heading hierarchy or table scoping. If you're aware of these things, then it becomes easier for you to kind of like work together and collaborate and hold each other accountable.
Yeah. And I will admit our team has had a lot of success in that area, actually. Mm-hmm. We've got a project in the works right now that I've been thrilled that all of our early discussions that we have had with the first round of like design comps and everything have all included multiple questions about, can you change this color because we can't build it without violating contrast standards?
Excellent.
Because, the person designing it didn't know. In fact, the person designing it was following a pattern that we do use on our website now.
Whoops.
We just have not gotten to a point where we could change it yet. But with new stuff, we can, you know, with the new development, we can say, mm-hmm. you know what? New development, we're not going to make that way. And they're brand colors.
Oh.
You know, it's one of those things that, you know, the brand colors are the brand colors. And you have to find, you know, in those situations, the trick is to find different ways to implement those colors. You know, you can't just use them any way you want to as a consequence of that.
Yeah.
And that can be an incredibly difficult thing to make people who get paid a lot more than you understand.
Yeah. Like, I don't care if it doesn't look right.
Yeah, it's the, can you change the color? No, you can't change the color. That's our brand color. That is literally the brand standard. And they're right. It is the brand standard, but that doesn't mean we have to use it here. And so, to your point, though, I've been thrilled that we've got all of our team members thinking about that constantly, mm-hmm. and we've got QA that goes in and checks that. But I'm also not going to pretend like that's not a fairly unique thing, I think.
I think that it's important for people, for like, you know, senior people, the OG internet people like you and I, to, as when we mentor newer developers, to, you know, affirmatively bring up the issue of accessibility.
Absolutely. Yeah. Any chance we get, and that's true too, like going back to little Jimmy looking up how to make a yellow text at 10:30 at night, the thing that he finds should have a note there.
Please
that
don't
says,
do this.
Well, no, I mean, do it. You can use yellow text. You just have to use it in the right context.
Right.
And in most cases, it's not the right context. But you can do it and have it be accessible.
Sure.
But that information should inherently come with a caveat that says, use this, but mm-hmm. if you're going to use it as a font color, make sure you have checked X, Y, and Z. And in most cases, it doesn't. And even if it does, most people don't read all that.
Or even easier, just say like, if you're gonna use this color, here's a good background that would complement it, and it has the right font contrast ratio. Or just say like, if you have this color, this is the font contrast ratio against these different backgrounds.
Yeah,
I don't know. This is an imaginary tool that we're not actually looking at. So
sure. No, I have an analogy that I really like, and I've been thinking about it a lot more lately, and it's one that irritates people because of what the end of it is. So I compare this to construction. I've always thought about web development from a construction standpoint. My dad was a carpenter, and so I think I just kind of rooted it there. But there are a lot of parallels, I think, from a process standpoint, from a specialty standpoint. And I think that bakes into why we have so many problems with this, though, because there's one area where we don't at all align, mm-hmm. and it's the thing that makes the difference. So when you're building a building, you've got a new business downtown that you're gonna go make, and they want this building made, and they've gone and they've hired their architect, and they've got the contractors lined up who are gonna get all the teams together to build all this, and then they're gonna line up connecting with the inspectors at the city to make sure all your code enforcement is right. And that's the thing. Because code enforcement isn't so much about literal code in our industry. It's about the standards enforcement.
Right.
When you're in construction, when you're building buildings, every city has its own codes. Most of them use the International Building Code as their like baseline. This is the way things need to be built. And you have to have a city inspector sign off on those things. And if a city inspector walks into your four-story building and sees that you don't have an elevator, he is going to shut your project down and you're going to have to fix it, even if the architect was too dumb to know that he needed to put in an elevator shaft in the design. Or
it's also things like how big load-bearing joists have to be, right?
Right.
Or how wide walkways have to be, or hallways.
Yeah, very, like, invisible kind of ideas, right?
Things we just take for granted.
Things we take for granted, but things that also don't make themselves apparent if you don't need them, certainly.
Right.
You know, a lot of people never see alt text on an image, so it just doesn't occur to them that that's even a thing. But that, and I'm going to use this word again, that nexus of those skill sets is made possible, and as a result, we build accessible buildings now. The bottom line of this is, the reason it works, the reason we build accessible buildings is because it's regulated.
Yeah.
And it's heavily regulated.
For good reason, though.
For good reason. But try to convince a world of web developers that we need regulation and enforcement of these standards, and you would have a revolution on your hands. Not a revolution, a war.
I think this is a good analogy, because the reason we have regulation is because if you didn't, or like building, with building code at least, if we didn't have building code regulation, then there would be an incentive, a cost incentive, to not make hallways wide enough for wheelchairs, or to not make tall buildings have elevators.
Yeah, 100%.
And so because we don't have that with web, where there's no regulation requiring that, because it would be an extra cost. And so most, according to the Ethan Marcotte article, most websites don't want to spend that cost. They're taking that cost incentive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it is. If you went to somebody and said, yeah, I need this website built, but I also want to make sure we pass WCAG AA on everything, you've probably, possibly doubled the price. But here's the thing. Most folks don't even know to ask that question. As a business owner, they don't even know to say those words.
We'll have an example later, but right now, if you are a person who has difficulty using a website, Amazon or whatever, and then you file a lawsuit, etc., under the ADA, you know, that then maybe the website thing gets changed. So imagine if building code was like that, where, like, I mean, I guess it is sometimes, right?
Anymore, certainly. Yeah. Especially
like if you don't have a wheelchair, if you don't have a wheelchair ramp or something, that would be the equivalent.
There's always, you know, stuff is always grandfathered in, of course. You know, old buildings, things like that tend to not have to deal with it. Anything city owned in most municipalities, they have to, you know, fix things in order to use them. I hate it, because it really takes a knife to this idea that we just said earlier about, you know, how we encourage people to dive into code, learn by doing, all of that. If this industry was regulated in that fashion, we completely eliminate the ability to do that, because to build a site, you would then be required to go to school, basically.
Yeah.
Is what it amounts to. And not everybody can do that. And we already know that access to this is the difference between some people having a career and not, and getting ahead and getting out of bad situations. Like, there's a ton of research about accessibility to the technology in general is a major factor in the economic status of the people mm-hmm. who have access to it. And so it's dangerous to say it. And I'm not saying, when I say regulation is the answer, not saying that I think that it's a good answer or that I would advocate mm-hmm. for that, because I don't. But I do think that those two things are the fighting forces, and it's why we have the inaccessible web that we do today. That is the consequence of it.
I think that playing devil's advocate here, the big difference between the construction analogy and the web analogy is that if a building is built incorrectly, it could be structurally unsound, it could collapse, it could, in a best case scenario, result in loss of, you know, damages to the building and loss of money. Worst case scenario, it kills people. If a website is inaccessible, then people can't use it, which is, you know, shouldn't happen. But, you know, it's easier to change a website than it is to change how a building is built.
Yeah, but follow that to its logical conclusion, though, because in the end, you know, building codes cover more than accessibility. They cover mm-hmm. electrical, they cover plumbing, right. they cover all this other stuff. And in any world where we did that with web, accessibility would not be the only thing regulated. Security
true.
Would be one. And that's so when point. You say you build a bad website, yeah, you know, what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
Well, if you're storing a lot of, you know, private data in a really bad way, a whole lot of bad stuff could happen. I mean, yeah, the risks are different, certainly.
Well, we have, but, I mean, for that matter, we have PCI compliance. If you're doing payment, payment processing, you have to be PCI compliant. And I think there's I know at least in the government sector at USCIS, we had the 508 compliance, which was like, I mean, that was part of the build process. You know, you deploy your branch to staging, and then you have one of our 508 experts review it, and then they have to sign off on it before it goes to production.
So usually. here's a takeaway at this point, because we had said at one stage of this early on that, you know, there's nothing that forces you to be accessible on the web. And I'm sure folks went, isn't that what Section 508 is for? And so there's an article, and this was also something that Aaron found and shared, but there was a quote in it that I need to give you guys. This was about an ADA lawsuit that was filed against a city or county. The guy was filing lots of lawsuits, and I have my own feelings about that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There was a chunk of text in it, though. Here's what it said. In June 2018, 103 members of the U.S. House of Representatives asked the U.S. Department of Justice to, quote, state publicly that private legal action under the ADA with respect to websites is unfair and violates basic due process principles in the absence of clear statutory authority and issuance by the department of a final rule establishing website accessibility standards, unquote. The House members also asked the DOJ to, quote, provide guidance and clarity with regard to website accessibility under the ADA, unquote. That I think sounds like a lot.
I think the outcome of that was that the DOJ declined to.
Yeah, the DOJ just said, you guys are nuts.
Yeah.
But my point being, it's 103 members of the House of Representatives is, you know, that's 20% of the House of Representatives, give mm-hmm. or take. And the key to that whole quote, there's one word that whole thing hinges on.
Private.
Private legal action. What they're saying is private companies have no obligation to follow those rules, or shouldn't, unless a very clear rule is established under the ADA. Right now, it's just kind of assumed that these things go together. And from a legal standpoint, that can be dangerous. So I say all of that to just emphasize the idea that this is not, like, solved territory. It's not a solved problem.
I think, okay, so on one side there, you have those 103 representatives are saying that they think that the private sector should be afforded a very clear bullet point list. You know, if you check all these boxes, then you can't be sued. Or at least you have good grounds for a defense. But on the other hand, though, whether or not a website is accessible, I mean, like, we all know the jokes about unit tests, right? Like, unit test passes and it's like a door that opens the wrong way or something. you know, you can check all the boxes and the site could still be inaccessible or have accessibility issues. So it's kind of a gestalt thing. It's kind of a, you know it when you see it kind of thing. And I'm glad that the DOJ recognizes that, because I think that had they said, like, yes, here's the checkbox list, I think we'd be missing out.
And there's, these statements come across a little trite, and I know that, but things like accessibility is never done. A website is never finished. But the reason those kinds of phrases are meaningful here is that it doesn't matter where you work. Most places that have a website do not have a full-time web person on staff. They bring somebody in to build the site, they do it, and then they leave.
That I hadn't considered. That's a good point. Yeah. Like a restaurant, the restaurant website that we mentioned the restaurant episode.
Yeah. How many restaurants do you know have a web developer on staff? Name one, please. Don't tell me Applebee's.
Right.
And it's, you know, this creates this sort of wave of a process, and the process is never able to overtake the wave as a result, because for a lot of places, it's always a catch-up game. Then, you know, 4 months into a project or 4 years down the road, they change a tool.
Yeah.
This was something that, Aaron, you were talking to me about before we started the show, right?
Yeah.
You had a great tool.
Right, yeah.
And then it was decided by people that weren't you to change the tool.
Yes, it was... I'll give the very abstract description of it. It had really cool, like, it was a CMS that we had at Cornell, and it had, like, really cool, like, it would warn you if you didn't have alt text, and it would check for, like, overuse of certain tags. It had really tight restrictions on what tags and classes you could use. But, you know, leadership decided to go in a different direction with CMSs, and so we don't use it. We didn't use it anymore.
The tool changed, it set the whole process back behind the wave even further then.
Right.
And so there are all these factors that come into play that, you know, this reason why it always feels like you're playing catch up and everybody says, well, just include accessibility at the start of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Folks, the conversation's been going on for 25 years. isn't a thing, you know, most folks are not working somewhere where they're getting to do something from the ground up scratch where they can really do that.
I think that it's okay that the process stays ahead of the wave, or rather the wave stays ahead of the process. I think as long as it doesn't outpace it, like, you know, if you're surfing it, you're never going to get, or you don't want to get on the other side of the wave. You want to stay like right under the curl, or like right in front of it.
Sure.
I think that's okay. And you know, it's okay to just be right there and not quite be on the other side. I think it would be problematic. And I think it's kind of where we're going now, and that's why we're having so many discussions about this. If you get where the wave is just gone, like the wave has already crashed into the shore and you're still out in the ocean.
That's lawsuit territory is what that means. There's also this idea, and I say this with all love in my heart, that content authors are dumb. And that's, they aren't, not in a general sense, but about this they are. And I always use this idea of, you know, the secretary in the art department, you know, who's been tasked with, you know, other duties as assigned, will go update the website. She doesn't know what alt text is, and she's not going to come to your training where you explain what it is.
And really, is it her responsibility to know those things?
No, it absolutely isn't. That has been thrust upon her, but that's the way the web gets built, unfortunately. Right. It happens everywhere.
It would be like if you asked that same secretary to move a couple pallets of goods down in the warehouse, right? Like, you wouldn't do that because, well, there's regulation rules about who can use the forklift. But, I mean, you know, she hasn't been trained, or he or she hasn't been trained. And so you wouldn't expect it to be executed perfectly.
Right. And our tools aren't good enough for that. That's sort of the gap there, is that the tools that we put in front of these people, and to your example, Aaron, you know, if you're using WordPress, normally, WordPress doesn't require alt text. It doesn't require a description. It doesn't require a caption. None of that has to be put in, and there's nothing context-aware about it so that when you do put it in, it doesn't highlight the thing in red and throw up a box that says this image doesn't have alt text. There's no feedback loop on any of this stuff.
That would be a nice thing to have added to WordPress, would be mandatory alt text.
And the consequences are very real. If you've ever used a screen reader, and I'm sure you haven't, because I've never seen you wear glasses. I don't think you wear contacts.
Not yet.
So you've got good eyes. You don't need to use a screen reader. I don't need to use a screen reader. But there's a video clip that's linked in Ethan's article. We'll include it in the show notes too. But I want you to hear just real fast here what this sounds like when somebody is using a screen reader and hits an image that doesn't have any alt text on it.
Heading level 2. Image with no alt attribute. You are currently on a heading level 2. / example 1, 2, 3, JPG image. You are currently on an image.
Yeah.
So imagine going to a gallery page, you know, a news article that's got, you know, 15 pictures from an event, and hearing that 15 times.
Go ahead.
Not only do you not know what happened, but it just takes up time.
So I mentioned the scoping thing earlier. This is something that I learned about at USCIS, but if you have a table head, TH tag, and then you have to say, is that table head tag, is that for the row or for the column?
Right.
So if you say scope equals row, then what happens is a screen reader won't reread the table head tag each time. Or it's something like it makes assumptions about what that table head tag means when reading through the items. And there's an example. I'll find a couple of videos on YouTube. I encourage you all to look it up. Look up like JAWS screen reading or something on YouTube, and you can see examples of people using this. It's really amazing. I know we've mentioned it before on the show, but seriously, check it out.
At the end of the day, the only takeaway, there's only one thing we can say about this, and that's the fact that when it comes to accessibility, all of the responsibility is on you and me and Aaron to just keep talking about this.
Yeah.
We need to work it into training cycles. We need to work it into documentation.
I was going to say, if you've got Slack at work, like we use Slack, I think you do too.
Yeah.
Right. If you've got Slack, find people who are into accessibility or who like it and make a Slack channel and, you know, talk, just start talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Get a handful, get some QA folks in there. Get, you know, your developers in there, one or two of them. Get a designer in there. Get that representation of that nexus that we've talked about. Get those people in there and use them, you know, they are Hugh Borg. You're going to use them to infect the rest of the collective and get them to understand the importance of accessibility.
More voices is good.
Now, number 2 for the evening, for the day. Doesn't matter, whenever you're listening. Web component design systems. Now, if you listened to our last episode, great. If you haven't, go back and listen to it, then come back to this, because I think that there's a lot of good information that factors in here. And it's this idea of using web components in your development. And that has a lot of context to that a lot of folks aren't familiar with.
So when I saw this article, design system, it immediately called to mind the episode with Greg Pedanovich,
right?
Number 14, right?
14.
Yeah. And but a design system is not the same as a design philosophy.
Yeah.
Right?
So he was talking about design philosophy, which factors into design systems, certainly.
Okay.
And so like there's this idea, right? You have design systems, you have pattern libraries, you have style guides, and so there's all these words. Basically, we got word salad, but they aren't the same thing. There's an article. So first off, the article we're talking about is from the Ionic Framework, which is they started out, they were like a React-based component system, and they reinvented themselves as a web component system. And so this article is from them. So there is, take that with a certain grain of salt, because obviously they have an interest in promoting their own system. But design systems, there's an article at uxpen.com that we'll have linked, and they've got a breakdown of this that I think is the best one that I could use. So I'm going to use it directly. They explain that a style guide is another subclass of a design system. The static documentation describes the design system itself, how products should look and feel, use cases for UI patterns, correct typographic scales, etc. The pattern library is also the subclass of the design system. It's the set of design patterns for use across a company. Now, this is me talking. That pattern library will be informed by the style guide. The things in the pattern library will reflect that.
Does pattern library mean like visual patterns?
Yes.
Like houndstooth, for example?
Right.
That's a weird example, but okay, so not like UI patterns or programming patterns.
Yeah, yeah. It's not going to have code styles. It's not going to have user flows. These are going to be examples of elements and things that use on your site. Typography, things like that. The style guide, like as a comparison, it will say, the style guide will say, we use this font. This is our font. We mandate these kinds of padding and things like that. But it will also include things like, this is how we sound. You know, this is the way we write stuff. This is the way we use our colors. This is the way we should display our logos, things like that. The pattern library would then have usable examples of those implemented. The design system is all of that crammed together.
Oh, cool. So one thing that I discovered from that article, the Ionic Framework one, was webcomponents.org. And they have like a, if you go to /introduction on that site, they have like kind of an overview of what it is. But like, this is kind of a big, this is like, what are those CSS frameworks? There's the Tachyon.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
This would be like Tachyons, right? It's like that kind of generalized web tech approach.
Yeah. And we talked about this a little bit, and I say in the last episode with Brian Olendijk. Because what he is doing with Hack's editor is building a block editor that is entirely based on web components.
Yeah.
And so this will be a little bit of a review, because we did talk about that in the last episode, but it's good to rehash. The web component standard is like this, it is a thing that lives within some other items. So that comes into things like custom elements, that comes with Shadow DOM and these kind of tools that together create a web component.
So I think you've maybe learned a little bit more about this than I have at this point from talking to Brian, but can you explain briefly for our listeners what a web component is?
So the example I gave in that episode, I'm going to reuse it because I still think it's probably one of the best ones that people will relate to, is AMP pages.
Okay.
If you're using an accelerated mobile page, or you've looked at an accelerated mobile page, go pull it up in your browser and do a view source on it. Mm-hmm. And you'll see all these tags, and some of them are normal. P tags. Mm-hmm. P tags are everywhere. You know what a P tag is. But then you'll see an AMP image, AMP-image tag, instead of a normal IMG image tag.
Right.
And what they have done is they have created their own component that is the AMP-image and redefined the way they intend for it to be used in the context of that page.
Okay, so this is kind of like how the Modernizer JavaScript plugin allows older browsers to play nice with modern HTML?
A little bit, but it's kind of the reverse of that.
Okay.
It's more like teaching browsers how to use HTML that doesn't exist yet.
Cool.
Because the whole idea is you come up with your own tags. I want to create a car called a car. I'm thinking ahead too far, and I'm trying to finish my gingerbread while I'm at it. I want to create a card that is Phenon-car.
Okay.
Because the dash is important. The dash is part of what defines the custom element.
Okay.
When I write that tag, I may give it some properties. I may say Phenon-car year equals 1953.
Okay.
Make equals Chevy. Model equals Bel Air. And that tag, when put into a browser, knows that I am supposed to render out, you know, a image of a 1953 Bel Air with a link to the Wikipedia article on it, and, you know, some other content that maybe is defined inside that tag or anything else I want.
Okay.
It's a wrapper. It's an abstraction layer. Because right. inside the definition of that web component, you are including all of your HTML and things that would say, this is how this works. This is what the browser is actually seeing. That's what the shadow DOM is.
I think I saw one of the examples was like a podcast-player tag.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was really elegant. And actually, it reminded me a lot of WordPress shortcodes.
Yeah.
Except, I mean, a little different. Like, WordPress shortcodes work differently.
It's like a WordPress shortcode that works anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anywhere with the appropriate web component, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to include the stuff. Yeah, you can't just use it without the dependencies. The close analog to this, we talked with Dustin in episode 31 about styled components.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very similar idea to something like that, you know, React components.
But this doesn't require, like, a framework.
Right.
It's just kind of drop in place.
That's the huge advantage that this has over other things, is that if I have a React component, that's awesome, but I can't use it anywhere else. It's a React component. It's literally in the name. And that was the argument that Ionic made with their framework.
They're
our stuff isn't portable.
Right.
And that's their argument, too, with the design system thing, is that maybe part of your team is using React, but that doesn't mean everybody is or is using the same version of it. A big company may be very dynamic and very differentiated in the technologies it uses, the stacks it uses, anything like that. Having web components in play abstracts all of that away in a standards-based way, and that's something we didn't use that phrase yet, but web components is a standards-based utility that you can use to create your own custom stuff, so you know it's going to work the same everywhere.
Okay.
And it is supported across the board.
I like that. But going back to what we were saying about accessibility earlier, are these accessible?
Hmm. So that's where we get back to this discussion of things like the Shadow DOM.
Yeah.
The Shadow DOM is an abstraction of the DOM for that element.
Right.
So if you view source, you're going to see this weird custom element. Have you ever looked at like an iframe in a view source, not view source, but like in the inspector in Chrome?
Yeah.
And you know that when you hit an iframe, you notice there's like a tag. I think it says, what is it? It's like a hash document root or something like that.
Right.
And then it gives you another page, but it's nested inside.
Right.
That's how Shadow DOM works.
Got it.
It's kind of like an iframe that isn't an iframe, but it has many of those features. It's abstracted away from the rest of the DOM. There's no style leakage in or out.
So if you inspected Phoenix Car, would you, in the inspector, like ViewSource may show Phoenix Car, but in the inspector, is it going to show the HTML that's generated by Phoenix Car?
You'll see the Phoenix Car, but then you'll see, and I think in Chrome, I think it literally just says Shadow DOM, and then it gives you the DOM for that element that you have defined inside of your spec. And that DOM is just normal HTML elements. Or it could be other web components in that case. But in most cases, you're not, you know, it's not turtles on turtles on turtles. You're just trying to abstract a layer out. So it's going to have whatever divs, spans, whatever you need. But it means that now when I've got my car gallery up, and I realize I've made an accessibility mistake. I forgot to include alt attributes.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe how stupid I was.
After doing this episode,
after even all of the talk we've done about this, I made this web component. I didn't put alt tags in it. All I have to do is update the JavaScript file that contains the spec for the web component. And now all of those instances are now updated.
Oh, right. Because they're all referencing...
Because they all reference the spec. It's abstracted. So
very cool.
The only way that breaks then is if you were to like actively change the name of a property or something like that.
Right.
Which
doesn't
happen in most cases. Like you would rather add something on than change something that's existing in that situation.
But this is a problem that's already kind of not solved, but we have an awareness of it as developers when doing like building class APIs or something.
Yeah, totally.
You know, when Yeah, you try to keep the public interface as unchanged as possible, and then just change things underneath. It's the right. open-closed principle.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, open. Yes, that's the word.
Yeah.
Thank you. I was not going to get there. I'm on my last glass, but I've got a whole shaker here that I've finished off. So
I'm envious.
But yeah, so this is why web components work. This is why it's good for a design system, because when those unknown unknowns come up, when you discover, yeah. oh, hey, we saw that you have the wrong role on an element, or you're not using right. ARIA tags properly here or at all.
Yeah.
All you have to do is change your spec and you fixed it everywhere. This was something Brian specifically talks about
right.
with, like, I think it was their video player component. They keep making it better and they don't have to change anything in the content itself.
I like that a lot. Okay, wait. So you mentioned styled components earlier.
Yeah.
How does this work with CSS?
So, yeah, it's semantically very similar. Like, you would embed, in most cases, the CSS within the web component.
Okay.
You are not required to do that, certainly. You could include a CSS file that is built out with SAS and all that, so you can use all your same variables and mix-ins and functions and all of that.
Yeah.
And in most cases, that probably would be the preferable way to do it. But you could do them very much like a styled component, where all of your styles are defined within that element.
Right.
And they are uniquely scoped to, and you mentioned tachyons earlier.
Yeah.
I think of it kind of like atomic design, but these are like,
right.
these are completely self-contained molecules in the atomic design sense. And so you never have to change anything outside of them if something is wrong.
Hypothetically, if we had like a, not a video player because you wouldn't see text there, but maybe like a, I don't know, a podcast player that showed like the title of the podcast or something using a text tag.
Yeah.
Would you be able to change, and like, let's say that the component creator defaulted it to yellow text, but you're using a white background. And you're savvy enough to know that yellow is not a good contrast ratio for.
But it was background. He thought it was okay because it was really dark yellow. So
yeah, yeah. So you want to make your website better? Can you use like simple CSS to just change that text color?
Yeah, because again, there's no scope leakage.
Right.
When you affect that element, you're only changing that element.
And so when. So you'd be able to hook onto that using CSS and then just kind of have the benefit of cascading on your site without having things leak out of that. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is if you're talking about like a CSS file, for instance, mm-hmm. you would need to make sure that the component is importing the same CSS file that your page is.
Right.
Because it is, right. it is sandboxed, basically.
Oh, okay.
So, like,
okay.
yeah, it won't be affected by, at least, and if I'm saying any of this wrong, please correct me, but the way the Shadow DOM works, because it sandboxes the element, by default, it won't reflect a change to your root CSS, unless the root CSS is also included in that element.
Okay.
So, like, if you've defined all the CSS locally inside the web component, and you change, like, the H1 color, because you think you're going to change the color in the component, you're not going to change the color in the component doing that.
I think that might be the only thing I don't like about this so far. I think that the site's CSS should be able to like overlap onto the component.
Yeah.
But I think maybe that can happen in the future, though.
But it's the difference, right, between sharing or integrating. If you're integrating mm-hmm. web components of your own choosing into your own project, that's a solved problem. You just include the root CSS with it. It's cached in your browser already. It's not like it's re-downloading it or anything.
Right.
And so
right.
then any changes you make to that file would affect the component.
Or you could even have like a separate CSS file that's just for components.
Certainly. 100%. Yeah. If it's somebody else's component, because there's a whole library of web components that you can just go download. It's kind of like NPM, but for web components.
Yeah. Crazy.
Those are something somebody else has written. And so they're totally self-contained. Again, like thinking about this molecule idea, you can just pick them up and use them in space. Like, they don't, you don't have to link your CSS in it. You don't have to do anything else unless you just want to change it, in which case you would just change it in their, you know, in the include at that point. There's an article over at Free Code Camp that actually addresses accessibility on web components. That's going to be linked in the show notes too, that you should check out. But this all comes back to this idea that this method becomes very future-proof. Because if you find that mistake, if you find, you know, improper markup or missing something or improving accessibility, changing the spec changes it in all the places the components used, and you're not forced to go back and redo anything.
I like this. I think it feels incomplete. Like, I think that, like I mentioned before, I think the CSS thing, but overall, though, I think this is a good... This feels like this could be a good direction to go in for, like, the growth of how we do web.
Yeah. The more I have learned about it and the more I've researched on it, I've been building Gutenberg blocks lately.
Mm-hmm.
That's been, for the last several weeks, all I've been doing for work for the most part. And as I'm doing it, the more I'm doing it and the more I've learned about it, I've discovered that, A, dynamic blocks are your friend. Especially in development. But there's a problem, right? When you write a block, and this is going to get a little technical, so I apologize, and it may not translate well over audio, but we're going to try. When you write a block, you define an edit and a save function. The edit function shows you what the thing looks like in WordPress's editor.
Okay.
The save function is what runs when you hit the save or the update or save button. Publish button in WordPress.
Right.
And then that gets moshed into the content for the page.
Yes.
If you then change your markup and change the structure of it, because like, and this is exactly what happened to me as I was building what I was calling the complex header. We had this header that goes on elements that needed a word on one side with a little like descriptive text on the side and an icon.
Yeah.
And so I made a block called a complex header. But I was working. I was changing, you know, does the icon go inside the H2, outside? Is the P tag, you know, is it inside a div? Can I just use it outside? And so I was moving stuff around as I was building this to get the CSS right. But what I discovered was, as I would save it out, I kept breaking it over and over and over. Because when Gutenberg would reload, it would say, hey, my edit says this. And my saved output says that when I process the edit, it should look like this. But the code that is in the page, that is saved in the page as a result, doesn't match. What do you want to do?
Huh.
And this has become a big argument in the Gutenberg community over whether or not blocks should be allowed to rewrite the markup of previously saved instances.
Oh, man.
Because... technically, it's very difficult. Technically, it's an incredibly hard thing to do because it's saved. It literally renders out a text blob and saves it into the content field.
Right.
And so how does WordPress know that it should go back and rewrite, you know, 1,300 instances of a given block if your site's big? And then another folks say, like, the blocks should not get to... redefine the content the author wanted when they wrote it.
Right.
And I get it. Like, I get the argument through and through. But that doesn't change the fact that there are completely legitimate purposes where I might want to, because I may realize I've nested items in a way that hurts a screen reader.
Right.
I didn't include an ARIA role in the right place, or I want to include an ARIA role, and I want to give the user the ability to say, what is the role of this element? But if it changes the markup, I break the block validation. And so web components, I think, are the solution to this. I think the future of Gutenberg blocks in WordPress, if you're building custom blocks, I think you should be building or web components. I think that is the right way to do that. The more I have thought about it and the more I've looked at the consequences, I think that has to be the right way to go about it.
I wonder how different... Or how difficult it would be to, like, boil that ocean and, you know, and swap out React in exchange for, like, web components instead.
Well, you can't just swap out React.
How I have not been keeping up with WordPress.
So this is, but this is sort of the neat part, and it kind of underlines this idea, and the one that Brian made excellently. Web components are standards based. It works everywhere.
Oh,
so okay. Gutenberg is written in React. And if you are working, like, you want to do inspector controls, things like that, you know, you're using React components. And they've got this huge library of all of these React components that you can use in your Gutenberg blocks. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredibly similar process, except that if I want to use a text control in something that isn't Gutenberg, I can't mm-hmm. do it because it's a React component. It only works in the context of React.
Right.
My web component works everywhere.
Yeah.
Just by dropping it in and enqueuing my JavaScript as part of the initialization function, it will just work. And
it's wild.
That may sound crazy. Like, it may sound like I'm being stupid over simplification-y Michael thing. I don't know which word was the adjective in that sentence, but...
Michael. Michael was the adjective.
Michael was the adjective. That's not always incorrect, as it turns out. But it really is that simple.
That's crazy, man.
Defining a web component is a very easy thing. When you set up your block in WordPress, you define which scripts are for the editor, which scripts are for the front end, and you enqueue them. And you would just say, yeah, enqueue my web component JavaScript with this block, and you're done. It's really empowering, and it makes it easy to update these things moving forward. You know, this idea that they're useful everywhere, and maybe more importantly to me, and kind of bringing it back to this idea of the design standard. Like, we've started using, we've got a project we're doing right now that we're going to be handing off to somebody, and then we're kind of going to be hands off from that point forward.
Oh, but if you're using web components in it, though, then you can indirectly update the way the content renders.
We could. We wouldn't in just the context of the relationship that we have in this case.
Right.
But I think more importantly, like, we took that opportunity to build out a pattern library.
Mm-hmm.
And so we used a tool called Astrum, which I've grown to really enjoy. It's incredibly simple. It runs, like, if you're using a GitHub repo and you use GitHub Pages,
yeah,
you can just have your Astrum pattern library run right on GitHub Pages. It's brilliant. But the pattern library can then showcase every time we make any kind of, like, block level-y kind of element that we need to show them how to use, we just add it to the pattern library. And we say, this is your testimonial block. You've got your testimonial rotator on the homepage. It's just testimonial-block, and you give it a list of the testimonials you want or something along those lines. And I can put it in the pattern library and have the code right there that is, if you want this type of block, here's how you do it.
This reminds me a lot of how Ruby gems work. And I guess, for that matter, like NPM modules. You import this one thing. So you import this component. But really, like, importing a single component, like the file, that could really include multiple components, couldn't it? It's just JavaScript, right?
Totally.
So, like, you could have, like, you know, a podcast component, and it could include, like, podcast player, transcript player, whatever, a couple different things that you could then include, and someone could put that in the header of their site, and it's sort of like bringing in a gem or a node module or whatever, and it gives them access to, like, this API of functionality that they can then use, and then if later on, if there's a new version, it gives them new functionality. I like this. I feel like it is a nice, it's the web borrowing something nice from the, like, command line programming world.
And so, it going back to the start of this part of the topic, this idea of how a design system is a collection of style guide pieces and pattern library components and things like this, what it lets you do is it take all of that stuff, wrap it up, and then make it easily reusable across everybody.
Yeah.
And as a result, it gets really hard to make mistakes with it. Because, you know, think about what you might do to, say, you know, make an interactive map. And you've got divs and JavaScript files and you know, nested sidebars and accessibility pieces and all this stuff. now, instead of having to rely on your developer remembering to use every one of those divs, and, oh, the padding on it's weird because he didn't put the wrapper div on it because that dude's a moron. Why? Of course you put the wrapper on it. Why would you not put the wrapper on it? That can all be integrated into your component. And you just say, when you're making a map, you just put map-component.
Yeah.
And you give it your latitude longitude and a zoom level, and it will take care of everything else that the brand needs from that point forward.
Getting back to a point we made earlier about how do we, as developers, and as even though the newer developers from us, how do we incorporate accessibility into our stuff? Maybe the solution is newer developers would be using web components, and then the accessibility stuff would be lifted initially upstream. And so as these components are being used, basic accessibility things are being incorporated. Maybe. Would that work?
I mean, a little bit. I think at the end of the... Well, and so one of the things that Brian was real keen on that we talked about in the first half of the show, this idea of context awareness.
Okay.
His tool is context aware, the Hacks editor. At least, you know, if the component that you're working on has been written that way. So one of the examples he gave was of his meme generator. And he would give it like a title and an image and, you know, a caption and all this. And the tool is smart enough to know what things support this. And it could match those together. But one of the other examples was foreground background color. And because the tool already integrated a calculation to compare hex values, you could know whether or not it passes WCAG AA standards.
Yeah.
And then present an alert to the user. And I mean, at that point, the sky's the limit. Do you want to prevent them from saving their content? Then do that.
Yeah.
Force them to pick colors that are contrasty. Force them to put in that alt text. Force them to do whatever you need to. Because if you're building your tools with that level of context awareness, you start to fix those problems. Because you're only able to fix the problems that you can calculate.
Sure.
And to throw back to the first half of the show, one of the things that was in Ethan's article was, or rather in WebAIM's research, all of the stuff that they found, let me see, here's the quote. He says, here's the real kicker for me being Ethan. He says, quote, WebAIM says, these automatically detectable errors constitute a small portion of all possible WCAG failures. In other words, these are just the errors that could be detected programmatically. The real picture is even worse than the numbers suggest.
Oh, that's sad.
Because accessibility is very qualitative in nature.
And it's not just the checklists. Yeah. It's not just the checkboxes.
Yeah, like you say, can you open the door? Yes, but you can't open it into a wall. You know, there are consequences, and there are things that aren't always objectively able to be substantiated. It's a very qualitative kind of thing. You know, you get into, and you could calculate this, but it would be hard, but contrast rules change with font size.
Right.
So it's
That's true.
So
yeah,
comparing color isn't actually enough. You have to compare color and font
and
size. And so I mean it would just be like a boost score or something on the color value, but it's certainly much harder. You know, it makes that calculation much more difficult. But there are tons of different qualitative accessibility experiences. And those things can't just be programmed into a web component and be taken care of. That's where you have to learn it. You have to be taught. You have to explain different things.
If someone were to make a really cool web component to display tables in a certain way, like, you know, we have like a data tables library with JavaScript.
Yeah.
What if you had a data tables component or something similar to that? And then while building that, you had proper table row and column scoping, and you had, you know, the correct, like tables don't have the alt text. They have the caption. Summary.
Or summary. Caption. Yeah, sorry, summary.
Yeah. And so it you know you'd have like the summary would be included there also, and you could require or throw an error or whatever if the user hasn't defined those, but you could kind of enforce accessibility issues through the use. It's like sort of like the trade off. Like, well, if you want to use our awesome component, you gotta cover these bases.
Yeah, and you should. I think that's exactly the right answer, and I think that anytime somebody says, oh, well, yeah, don't use this component because the guy that wrote it, it throws tons of errors.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. That's the point. And right. So let me explain to you why that is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it all comes back to, let's bring this full circle before we head out of here.
Yeah.
This idea of cost, right?
Mm-hmm.
Accessibility adds cost to things because you do have to do more work. You have to write the summaries. You have to make sure you have headers. You have to make sure you've taken care of alt text, that you've checked all your color contrasts on elements. Gutenberg, Gutenberg supports a color palette. It's very cool.
Okay.
When you're setting up your blocks or your Gutenberg configuration in your theme, you can actually define a color palette so that when somebody clicks an element and the color picker shows up, it has a list of swatches that are predefined to whatever like your brand colors are or whatever.
I like that. That is nice.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
No color checking on it whatsoever. You could pick the same color for foreground and background color. It's, stuff like that is going to drive me nuts at the end of the day because it's going to take somebody time and money to fix it. And somebody will always come up, like in the WordPress community, they're going to say, yeah, but we have a use case for that.
Yeah.
I don't know what that could be, but I'm sure somebody would come up with it.
I don't think that, we talked about regulation earlier. I don't think that regulation should be seen as the solution for this problem. I think that we as programmers should solve it. That's what we do. We solve problems. This is a problem.
Yeah. We should listen.
Yeah, yeah.
We should listen to the folks who are complaining. I mean, everybody is clear, I think, at this point. Matt should listen to everybody with Gutenberg who is complaining. Because the color picker is actually a good example, I think. You should probably not prevent publishing content if somebody has picked a foreground and background color on an element that don't pass contrast standards. But
make them aware.
It should absolutely throw an error. Or a warning,
or just
or something.
Yeah, I know that it's not enough ultimately, but I think for now, as a start, being aware that you're doing things like if you're gonna be an asshole, you should be aware that you're being an asshole. Maybe you don't know that you are.
No.
So,
I'm luckily as the more I drink, the less asshole-y I get. I'm just a fun kind of. Give me a topic. I may rant. Ranty. Folks, stick around with us for just a minute. We're going to check out, take a break, and come back, and we'll get you out of here. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at newcloud.com/drunkenUX. That's newcloud.com/drunkenUX. Well, I hope that was useful for you. It was kind of, abstract in its nature, but I like the way these topics dovetail and this idea of, being an advocate, being forward-thinking, and all of that plays together in kind of a very weird dance, but it's not unnatural, I think.
I like the idea, because I love new things and seeing cool ways that people are doing stuff. But I like being able to do that and simultaneously straddling this idea of, or I guess straddling both sides of, like, accessibility and the old ways versus new hotness and all that.
Well, and if this sounds like new and weird to anybody and you feel like, why haven't I heard about this? Keep in mind, web components only entered mainstream adoption last year.
Wow, that's like super new.
Yeah, it's very new, but it's very well supported across pretty much all the browsers. Since most browsers do auto updates, it kind of takes care of some of that. But there are polyfills and whatnot. You know, if you go to the site that Aaron mentioned, go to webcomponents.org. There's information there on all of this. You can find the polyfills you need. There are libraries that help you with this. Brian last week had brought up Polymer is one. Ionic, of course, has their own library that they use. It's called Stencil, I think, if I remember right.
Okay. I think I saw one for that.
Yeah, so there are a lot of ways to go about this, but remember, web components are a standard. You can use it now. It's like CSS Grid. You know, it's one of those things that is entered rapid adoption. And so you don't have to worry about, well, does Edge support it? Does Opera support it? No, everything, you're good. You're good to go.
Cool. Oh, and another shout out for Andy, A-N-D-I. There's a link in the show notes. Please check it out.
Andy, Axe Accessibility, Site Improves, Site Scanner. Throw those in your toolbar in Chrome and just have them.
Yeah.
It's
free.
Be an advocate. Check your stuff once in a while. Check other people's stuff and then tell them when it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't hurt either. Even if you're not blind or you're not, you know, deaf or have motor control issues or cognitive problems or anything. One of my favorites, I'm giving a talk. I'm going to go long-winded for a second. I'm giving a talk here in May at the Web Accessibility Summit on transcripts.
Cool. Oh, nice.
And one of the points I'm going to be making is, you know, accessibility doesn't mean deficiency. It can be very circumstantial, and some people listen to podcasts at work, or rather can't listen to a podcast at work. So they will look for a transcript, or maybe they don't have English as a first language, and so it's hard for them to follow a conversation in audio format, but with a transcript in front of them while they're listening, they're able to piece it together. There are a lot of those things that doesn't mean that you're just blind or deaf, and we've brought that up before. Like accessibility, we tend to think of it in these very like rigid structures, but it's not at all that simple.
There are times if there's a site that just has a video and there's no transcript, I will straight write out of that site. If I'm just looking for a quote or a portion of it or something or like one specific topic that's interesting to me, I'll control F if I can on the transcript. I love that.
If it's true for Aaron, you know it's true for everybody.
Well, I do have two A's in my name. So, sure, you can tell us how bad our opinions are there on the socials, Facebook and Twitter.com/DrunkenUX, and on Instagram/DrunkenUXPodcast. And don't forget to come check us out and yell at us on Slack at DrunkenUX.com/Slack.
And if you do see me, if you're in Missouri, you're headed to Springfield, you're going to be at the Web Accessibility Summit at the end of May, catch me. I'm going to have a giveaway or two that I'm going to take with me there, so that'll be a fun little thing to be announced then. I have it already. I just don't want to spoil the surprise yet. Folks, thanks for sitting with us. I hope this was useful to you. What are your favorite accessibility tools? What web components have you built or are you looking forward to using? Let us know.
Yeah, seriously, let us know.
I would love to hear what people are doing or how you're solving any of these problems. Big company, small firm, single one-man army, whatever. Because, really, the solutions do vary a lot and can be very tailored. So let us know. Because at the end of the day, I only have one piece of advice for you, and it's the only thing I can tell you at the end of this show, and it's to keep your personas close, but your users closer. Bye-bye.